Succession number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Reel 4. Now, could you tell us about this course at Sealand, RAF Sealand? What was that about?
Well, it was mainly a firing course. And I can't remember if it was the fifth or sixth week when we were at Gosling 5. We all got loaded onto a couple of lorries and shipped off to Sealand, which was about 30 miles away from the camp.
And that's spelled
SEA, is it? SEALEND. And I found out later it was near Harwood on a Harden where Gladstone had retired.
Now, what do you remember of this firing course? Take us to what you did on that.
Well, it was to introduce us to the real hardships of life, because we were all billeted in this disused classroom. We all had to sleep on the floor. There was no heating. There was a leading seaman who was in charge of the, if you like to call it, the general eating arrangements. And another leading seaman who was a bit of a tyrant, who was in charge of the firing course. And we used to spend, when we weren't firing, we used to spend time route marching. And that was about all that the Sealand course consisted of. But there we got introduced to the Lewis gun. We had to do Lewis gun firing.
And what did you think? Tell us about the Lewis gun.
Well, I quite like the Lewis gun. The main thing I found was you mustn't let it creep. If you let it creep, you gradually go over the target, you see, and miss everything. Of course, the leading seaman in charge would be so irate, he'd go to hit you with his megaphone, and then suddenly realise it wasn't done anymore, and just start swearing at you instead. So we spent quite a bit of time on the Lewis gun. We also did time on grenades. We had an officer.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was each one of us had to go in turn into a trench with an officer, and he'd say, "Well, what I want you to do," he said, "is when I tell you, take out the pin, but hold the firing catch. Don't let go of it, and don't drop the grenade. Otherwise, we'll have to get out of the trench pretty damn quick. And when I tell you, throw the grenade as far as you can, over the parapet, and wait for it to land, look at it, and when I tell you to get down damn quick." So I quite like that, throwing the grenades, you know. In fact, I was quite good at throwing grenades, when there's no enemy around, that is.
Did you do any other machine guns, or the Vickers, or the
Brett? I think we did the Vickers as well, but I'm a bit hazy on it. We did mainly the Lewis gun, but we did the Vickers as well.
Were you learning to strip down the Lewis, or...?
No, we did that later on.
So it was just firing at this?
Yeah, just firing the Lewis.
Now, then you went back to Gosling. Now, is that the end of your Gosling training, then?
No, we carried on then with our usual routine at Gosling until the final passing out parade, until we got the final assessments of where we were going. And what they did then was to say, right, two of you will be air fitters.
You told us this, but yeah.
Yes, and the rest will be air mechanics. And you'll start your general technical training right away, because there's four grades of air mechanics: engines, airframes, electrics and instruments, and ordnance.
Now hang on, where at?
Different camps. As far as I remember, airframes was at... because I never got involved in this. I don't.
No, it's where you went.
I went to be an air fitter.
Right. So where did you go?
To Fulham. After a week's leave, and I must emphasise that my main interest in becoming an air fitter was to go to Fulham, which was in London, of course, being near home, because by that time I thought I'd enjoy a few home comforts as well, and also the prospect of a raise of pay to five and twopence a day.
Now, what was the name of what you were joining at Fulham?
Well, it wasn't. There's no particular name. It's just an old disused gas works, and there was every class that. They did. The classes were again at about 30 people, but they'd wait until they'd got about enough people to fill a class, and then start another course. And
so, when did you start?
I started the first week in December.
43.
43, yes.
Now, how was the training as an air fitter organised?
Well. We had a large number of civilian instructors, and a lot of them were intended to teach us, to take us through the course, so that we could do the various trade test bits, which were largely based, I found since, on the old artificer course.
Now, what were these civilian instructors like? Where did they come from? What were they?
Well, they were ex-gasworks employees or ex-engineering people who had been selected by the ministry to train us. And I found them very, very good indeed. They were very good at teaching us the finer points of filing, sharpening drills.
Let's go through the course then. I mean, in as much detail as you can remember, how did they set about making you into an air fitter?
Well, they'd start off by saying, right, here's this bit of metal. Now, we want you to make it with... we want to indent the metal with a perfect square with two holes at the corners, and then file a bit of metal to go into that square... to be a good fit. And
how'd you learn to do that?
Well, they'd come round, you'd start off, those who'd never done it before would obviously have to have more training than I would, for instance, because I've done it before, before. But they'd come round, and the people that had never done it before would get a lot more instruction. But the civilian instructors were very, very good. And they'd show the people how to file square and flat, which is very important, and how to fit this, how to cut out the square out of the metal.
Do that with the file as well.
Do that with the file, yes. And then the bit, they'd get another bit of metal, which we'd cut and file up so that it would fit, just slip into the square. Not too hard, but just going perfectly. And that was the course. The course lasted about 10 weeks.
When you produced that, was that your trade test in filing?
Yes, but not nearly till the end of the course, because.
Well, did the bit you prepared, did that go forward as your example for the test?
Oh or yes.
Did you have to do it again.
Oh no, that would be your example. And I found out later that such was the need for the higher-ups in the Admiralty to get this bunch of technical aircraft people going, that even if your trade test bit wasn't all that good, you still passed the course. Because I think they began to realise that the old-fashioned method of producing metalwork wasn't required for aircraft work.
So that's filing metal and into squares. And what was the next thing in there?
Drilling holes, right. Making sure you could sharpen drills correctly so that the two leading edges weren't too much, were as equidistant as possible. Making sure that when you drill the hole. If you said drilling it with a quarter-inch drill, for instance, as it was then, the hole was about a quarter-inch in size. But if you drill the, if you sharpen the drill so that It was all hand sharpening in those days. There were no aids. If you sharpen the drill so that one edge of the drill was considerably longer than the other, the hole would be much larger. So it would be much larger than a quarter of an inch. So there's all that.
Was there a trade test for that?
Or yes, oh yes. There we used to have a chief who was a time-expired man but called back for the war. He's a pretty old bloke, in his late 50s. He was a dour Northern Irishman who, I found the, early on, I found the trick to succeed with him was to get there early and get the best drills. Because if you got the best drills, you wouldn't have to do too much sharpening and you could get them tidy. But anybody who arrived late would get the rough old stuff, even a broken drill. And they'd say to him, "Chief, this drill's broken." So he'd say, "Sharpen it then," with a very dour expression. And they'd say, "Oh, we thought we'd get a drill that was going to be better than this." So all his reply would be, with no change of face, and in a very soft voice, he'd say, "Are you after a spell of fucking jankers?" And of course they went off and did their best to sharpen the drill after that.
So there's drilling, filing, drilling, what else?
Learning how to, we've got a course on mechanical drawing.
Tell me about that. You wouldn't have done that at all.
No, I hadn't done that at all. But
how far did it go in with the mechanical drawing?
Well, quite good, because we had, again, a civilian instructor who would teach us all how to set out plans, elevations, how to do, in other words, how to do an accurate engineering drawing so that people coming along behind could make anything from that drawing. And I got a lot of help by another friend of mine who was in the class, who had done it before in his work, because by this time we were all mixed up again. People come from all over the place. And this chap was a Welshman, and he'd done mechanical drawing before. And in our spare time, he showed me some of the finer points. So that I learned quite a bit from him, as well as from the instructor.
Now, what else? Filing, drilling, mechanical drawing?
Marches, occasionally.
The technical stuff?
The technical stuff.
Lathe?
No lathes, no. Fitting, mainly fitting.
Sorry, yes.
Bit of soldering.
Tell us about soldering.
Well,
have you done any of that before?
No, I've never done any soldering before, but they used to give you, here's some leads. Here's some tags. We want you to prepare the end of the lead to such and such a measurement. Don't cut into the wire, because if you cut into the wire, well, you'll lose marks. Cut the outer insulation off very, very carefully. Prepare the leads. And then solder on the tags onto the end of the leads. And that would be one trade test we'd do for that.
Anything else? I know it's difficult, but not interviewed many people for this branch of the RN.
Well, another thing was they'd give you a piece of metal with a groove in it, and then another bit of metal, and they'd say, "Right, but I want you to solder that bit of metal into the piece with a groove in it, and see it get on, and make as decent a job of it as you can." And we'd have to do that. But mainly, the main course at Fulham, before you actually started your general technical training on aircraft, was to instruct you in how to do mechanical drawings, which incidentally I never had to do afterwards.
So, filing, drilling, mechanical drawing, soldering, anything else?
Naval history, that's all.
They're not, technical side?
Not really, no.
So that's about
a fairly 10-week intensive course, taking into account a lot of people have never done any work like that before.
So you were at a bit of an advantage?
Yes.
That there was also, from what you're saying, a continuation training of drill, naval history and other things.
Yes.
Would that look at anything new or was it just continuation?
Well, just a continuation. We got, we had one or two commissioned officers there who were instructors in the instructor branch, and they gave us, I had quite interesting chats with them off duty about different things I'd read about the conquest of Peru and all this sort of thing. One particular chap was very interested in the conquest of Peru, so I was able to have quite a long chat with him about that. But he'd give us bits and pieces, about an hour at a time, of different aspects of naval history. But we didn't get too much of that, not so much as we got at Gosling.
And drill and physical training?
Yes, a certain amount of that, not too much. There was a gym there, and leaping over horses and climbing up parallel bars, the usual sort of stuff. And
so you were there, so 10 weeks, so that's into Marchish.
End of March, yes. Just when the air raids were starting on London again.
I was just going to ask you about the air raids. Were you aware of them at the time?
Oh, yeah. Because they used to give people who... some of the older chaps were married. And I remember one chap who came from the area around the old Kent Road. And... he got not friendly, but conversant with the master at arms, who went by the nickname of Drip, because when he got excited or angry, he used to start dripping.
You said about the air raids.
Yeah. Well, he found out that Drip had left the Navy sometime before the war. And had invested his money, which he'd been very carefully saving, in some houses in the Old Kent Road. Well, after the air raids had started, this chap came back after night leave, as it was called, and in Drip's hearing said, "Gaw, terrific air raid in the Old Kent Road last night. Badly bombed." And Drip pricked his ears up and said, "Do you know where?" He said, "Yeah, there's a lot of houses there. Got smashed to the ground." And Drip was a bit of a heart case. And shortly after that, we never saw him anymore. Apparently he'd had a heart attack. And... he'd got hospitalised, but because we'd left early, we there was some more Drip.
So the practical joke turned a bit sour, really.
Yeah, really. Yes.
Now, what about the raids? Were there any in the Fulham area?
No. It was mainly in East London.
Now, anything else that happened before you come to the end in late February, early March?
Well, a scandal concerning the commanding officer.
Tell us about that.
Well, he was a lieutenant commander de Groot, and he was a Royal Naval Reserves officer, you know, with the entwined gold lace on his. And apparently what he'd done, he was having an affair with a nurse. And he'd got this nurse pregnant. And I only read about this afterwards when I was at Henlow on the last course of the lot. I found out that he was arrested by the police because somehow or other he got hold of some abortion medicine, which was a bit rare in those days, and supplied it to this nurse, who'd got very, very ill as a result. With the result, she'd blown the work, so to speak, told the police about de Groot. De Groot got arrested, and the last I heard of him, reading it in the News of the World at Henlow, where I was after Fulham, and he was in dead trouble with the police and was going to go on trial. But that was that.
Now, what happened to... So, you finished in late February?
Late February. I went on another week's leave and then went off to Henlow.
What was this? Was this RAF Henlow, is it?
Yes, because they did another selection board at the end of the course. They said, well, what do you want to be? Do you want to be airframes, engines, electrics and instruments, or ordnance?
Which did you select?
I wanted to be airframes.
Now, why? Why pick airframes?
Well, I thought that was more in line with my experience. I didn't know much about electrics at that time. Not much. But when the time came, they said, Bradbury, you go to Henlow for electrics.
But you picked airframes.
Yeah.
So what did you think of that?
Well, what do you think, really? I just thought, this is just typical, you know. So off I went to Henlow after a week's leave. And
so that would be February.
That would be, getting on into March, yes.
And it's 44 by now.
Yes,
it?
44.
And
yes.
What was the setup at Henlow? Was it a formal school or was it just part of the ordinary RAF?
It was a formal school actually, because they
did
used
have a name?
No, just RAF Henlow. And we got there, there weren't too many of us, because we'd obviously got thinned out a bit as the course had gone on. But the air fitters, Lit and myself, of course, we lived in the main camp, which was very fortunate.
And what were conditions like there? A
bit Spartan, but a bit better than what I'd been used to, so to speak.
In what way?
Well, there was a big dormitory there. We all had a bed, as opposed to bunks. And there was an officer there who's in charge of the naval entries.
What about the food?
Not too bad, quite good. And about 2 miles up the road, there was another camp which was much more primitive, I understand. I never went up there, and that was for the air mechanics, who were getting trained as air mechanics electrics. And they used to have to march into the main camp every day for their instruction, and then march back at night. So we were spared that, fortunately.
Now, you were trained as an air fitter electrics.
Yes.
How did they start your training? Because you didn't know much about this.
No, we had an introductory electrical course. We got explained what were amps, what were ohms, what were volts, and how they were all related, and how they worked in circuits. That was our very basic course.
Now, did you know any of this, or was it all new to you?
All new. Brand new. Knew nothing at all about it.
Did you have any trouble with it?
No, not really.
At a theoretical level?
No, it's quite easy, because...
Who was doing the lectures?
An RAF officer who was their sort of instructor. He was a squadron leader, and he was very good. He told us quite simply, and he was a good teacher. And I didn't find any great difficulty in picking up the elementary stuff in electrics. But how on earth I came to get there, well, as I say, you know.
That's the theoretical side. And what else were you doing at Henlow?
Batteries. Working on various types of aircraft to get used to working on wiring systems.
Now tell me a bit more about that.
Well, we had
the practical side then.
Yes, it's mainly all practical. There was a setup there for, mind you, it was mainly RAF orientated, because there had a section there for bombing equipment on bombers, which of course we never touched. And we had
tell me about the stuff you did do.
We did that as well. We went through that course. I went through the bombing equipment course.
Now, which do you want to do first, the electrics and the aircraft or the bombing equipment?
Well, Would it be better if I just told you roughly what the whole course consisted of?
That's what I'm trying to get to do. Right. Sorry. Well,
first of all, General Electrics to begin with.
We've done that, yeah.
Yes, and then we went on to batteries, learning how to top up batteries, how to test them, how to check them for capacity and all this sort of thing. And we did a fortnight in that course, and how to generally assess batteries, whether they had to be taken off aircraft and given over to ground use, because they weren't holding their capacity very well. And we had a good corporal there who was very good at teaching us about batteries generally, the types of batteries used on aircraft. We then went off to a hangar where they had a lot of old derelict aircraft, I suppose. There was a Barracuda there, for instance, which was a bit battered about. We had to, the instructor would put on snags onto the wiring, that sort of thing. He'd take out of the junction boxes, he'd take out a wire and put it into another connection and say, this circuit isn't working, get it working. And we'd have to fumble around and check the wiring and make sure that the wire went back in the right place. And generally speaking, try to get the thing working again.
So you'd go to the aircraft. Now, how did the aircraft circuits work? I mean, what form of electricity was it? Was it DC or AC?
It was all DC on aircraft. And when I was there, it was all 12 volt. And it was on the double pole system. In other words, both the positive and the negative sides were wired in. But a bit later on, to save weight...
As it was then, don't go ahead. Yeah. So you learned. So what sort of circuits, what do the circuits deal with that you were dealing with?
Landing gear, lighting, dropping bombs.
We'll come to that as a separate thing.
Yeah.
What else?
The batteries, how to put in the batteries properly so they didn't fall out of the aircraft when it turned over, that sort of thing. And how to make sure that the battery caps were in properly so that when the aircraft inverted, the lead acid didn't bubble out and leak all over the aircraft, that sort of thing. So I had to learn all about that.
And you did this on various different types of old battered out of it aircraft.
Yeah, because we had several spells on aircraft. As we got better, we'd then gradually progress to more complicated stuff. But
tell me about the bombing electrics.
Well, the bombing electrics. I remember we had there. A very forceful Corporal Baker, I remember his name was, who would tell us all about the various types of bomb selection gear, as he used to call it. And that would be for dropping a large number of low-weight bombs in succession. And this thing would go over, and it could be timed so that this contact could go over various other contacts and energize the bomb dropping gear, bomb release gear, either quickly or at greater intervals than, in other words, it was a graduated bomb release mechanism.
So they go in a set order once it started.
Once the bloke got over the target, whether it was a and it was mainly intended for railway junctions and all this sort of thing, bombing those sort of targets. An RAF machine would go over and with fairly low capacity, 100 kilogram bombs perhaps, or 50, even 50s, to bomb marshalling yards, railway junctions, all this sort of thing, and fly over the target. And release these bombs in succession.